This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello there. I'm Ben Marcus, and I'm thrilled to be here to introduce to you Deborah Eisenberg, a story writer that I have just always worshipped. I'm always a bit unnerved before I read a short story by Deborah Eisenberg. I know the intensity that awaits, and I'm not sure it should be entirely legal without some sort of license to create people merely from words, characters who are more lifelike than many real people I know, assembled with a language that is so medically exact, so mercilessly knowing, that I can't really make them go away, even when I close the book. When we read a Deborah Eisenberg story, we ride inside the bodies of her characters, swallowing their conflicts and agonies as our own. And it's an intimacy that can feel unbearably deep, affording us a view, a kind of psychological cutaway, into characters a bit too much like ourselves, which is to say, characters who can scarcely evade their own fears long enough to function as upright people in the world. It is an admirable kind of literary art that manages to articulate the complexity of being a person who will one day die, rendering the awful dilemma of loving, of becoming attached, of wanting things inside a world that will go on without us, inside a body that will soon erode. Not many of us want reminders of this problem, but it is arguably a vital task of the literary artist to chase this difficulty in vivid color, to make it from language, to let us experience as transparently as possible the way our minds and hearts work when we face up to and sometimes look away from our most unbearable difficulties. If misery is one of the holy grails that much fiction aspires to capture and animate, to convert into a complex spectacle, it is an absolutely biological imperative for Eisenberg's characters, who seem nearly to lust after it. And their craving, the strange drain-like action that sucks them down into suffering, is not without its desperately funny side. It's as though anxiety-inflated thought balloons hover over her characters, and worry is the wind that pushes them in and out of rooms. One of the finest things a short story can do is plumb a character's interior and discover the most elemental things, what they feel, what they fear. Eisenberg's motivation as a writer would seem to be this: to prove that no matter appearances and elaborate defenses, there is within even the most modest-seeming people a current of unsoothable terror. And it is the story writer's task to illuminate the deepest regions inside people, to stitch the chaos into something coherent. The techniques for doing this have been pretty effectively mapped out by writers who follow Chekhov's strict approach. And for the most part, Chekhov's innovations have proved remarkably durable and vital. With Eisenberg, however, it is as though the technology has finally been advanced. This really is a new way to write, and not silly new or vain new or just pointless new, but new in the replenished, revitalized sense, because she's effectively torn a hole in the language and added an original narrative dialect that lets her make people in brighter colors and higher resolution. This bears repeating. She makes people, and they really exist. Indeed, if you added a bit of organic matter to the page, there'd be people crawling out of her books, lurching into life, and you'd be advised to protect yourself. Eisenberg is a necessary writer because in a culture in which we think we've seen and heard everything, she demonstrates that much is still going undisclosed, that there are things yet to discover about what it's like to be a person in the world. In the end, what matters most to me about Deborah Eisenberg is that she doesn't just create characters and stories. She activates something viral in the language that infects us, her readers. This is her brilliance, not just what she writes on the page, but what she writes in those of us who read her, who she allows us to become during those moments when her remarkable short stories are pulsing in the air. You're about to find out for yourself. I envy and fear for those about to make this discovery for the first time. Please welcome Deborah Eisenberg. Thank you.
Hi. Thank you so much. I'm really, really thrilled to be here and honored and very happy to meet Ben in this way, whose writing I've admired for a long time. I'm going to read to you from my recent book, Twilight of the Superheroes, and it is a collection of five very long stories. As it happens, I'll be reading the shortest of them. But in order to keep it short enough for our purposes, I'm going to sort of lop off the first page or two and excise little bits. So I will want to get you a bit situated in the story, but I wanted to just say one or two things about it first, about the context of writing it. I wrote it very, very quickly for me, over a period of maybe 4 or 5 months, which really is fast for me, in the winter of 2003, which was a pretty bad time in many places, including New York. Everyone was in really a dreadful state, demoralized, frightened, miserable, filled with shame, I would say. People were desperately trying to get the news, and it was very hard to figure out how to get any real information. And of course, this is still the case, but we're kind of accustomed to it. And there were helicopters droning all over the city, and there were alerts about chemical and biological warfare, and all of it seemed transparently designed to induce and sustain a mood of disorientation and panic. And people felt manipulated as well as frightened. It was really unpleasant. And I wrote this story in a kind of rage. Its narrator is a young woman named Lulu, who lives on the West Coast with her boyfriend, Jeff. And she's come to New York to see her grandmother, who has recently had a very bad stroke. And we are going to pick up in the story where Lulu is, she's just arrived at her grandmother's, and the nurse, Eileen, is there, and Lulu is waiting for her brother, Bill, and Bill's wife to show up. The title of the story is Revenge of the Dinosaurs. And by coincidence, you've got the first page in your program, I'm told. Eileen accompanied me into the living room. Nana was dozing in one of the velvet chairs. Soldiers were marching silently towards us across the black and white desert of an old television screen. An attractively standardized, smiling blonde woman in a suit replaced them. "Does Nana watch this?" I asked. "She seems to like having it on," Eileen said. "I keep the sound off, though. She can't really hear it, and I'd rather not. Wake up, dear. Your granddaughter's here to see you." "It's Lulu, Nana," I said loudly. Nana surveyed me, then Eileen. I bent and kissed Nana's cheek. Nana winced. "It's Lulu, dear," Eileen shouted. One of Nana's hands lifted from the pale cashmere blanket across her lap in a little wave, as if there were a gnat. "I'll be in the kitchen," Eileen said. "Call me if you need me." I sat down near Nana on the sofa. I was not the gnat. "Nana," I said, "you look fabulous." Someone sighed loudly. I looked around. the person who had sighed was me. The last time I'd seen Nana, her hearing was perfect, and she was going out all the time, looking, if not still stunning, still seriously good with the excellent clothes and hair and so on. She was older, obviously, than she had been, but that was all, older. It's too drastic to take in. A stroke. One teensy moment, total eclipse. In my opinion, all moments ought to contain uniform amounts of change. X many moments equals strictly X much increase in age equal strictly X much change. Of course, it would be better if it were X much decrease in age. Oh, where on earth was Bill? Though actually I was early, because last week when I'd called my old friend Juliet and said I was coming to the city to see Nana, she said, sure, I could stay at her place. And naturally, I assumed I'd be hanging out there a bit when I got in from the airport and we'd catch up and so on. But when I arrived, some guy, Wendell, I think his name might be, turned out to be there too. Sure, let's just kill them. Why not just kill them all? He was shouting. Juliet was peeling an orange. I'm not saying kill extra people, she said. I'm just frightened. There are a lot of crazy, angry maniacs around who want to kill us, and I'm frightened. You're frightened, he yelled. No one else in the world is frightened? Juliet raised her eyebrows at me and shrugged. The orange smelled fantastic. I was completely dehydrated from the flight because they hardly even bring you water anymore, though when I was little it was also fun and special with the pretty stewardesses and trays of little wrap things, and I was just dying to tear open Juliet's fridge and see if there was another orange in there. But Wendell, if that's what his name is, was standing right in front of it shouting, what are you saying? Are you saying we should kill everyone in the world to make sure there are no angry people left who want to hurt anyone? So I waited a few minutes for him to finish up with what he wanted to get across, and he didn't. And I just dropped that idea about the orange and said, see you later, and tossed my stuff under the kitchen table and plunged into the subway. When Juliet and I were at art school together, all her boyfriends had been a lot of fun, but that was a while ago. Happy laundry danced across the screen on a line. Little kids ate ice cream. A handsome man pumped gasoline into a car, jauntily twirled the cap back on the tank, and turned to wink at me. A different, standardly attractive woman in a suit appeared. It was hard to tell on this ancient black and white set what color we were supposed to believe her hair was. Red, maybe. She was standing on the street, and a small group of people, probably a family, was gathered around her. They were black, or anyhow not specifically white, and they were noticeably fatigued and agitated. Their breath made lovely vapor in the cold. They jogged up and down, rubbing their arms. Someone was lying on the pavement. The possibly red-headed newscaster looked serene. She and the family appeared to have arrived at the very same corner from utterly different planets by complete coincidence. She had a pretty good job, actually. A lot better than selling vintage clothing, anyhow. And maybe she was getting some kind of injections. Then it was the blonde newscaster again, bracketing a few seconds, in which a large structure burst slowly open like a flower, spraying debris and kind of limbs, maybe. The blonde newscaster was probably getting injections herself. I might have caught some lines trying to creep up around near my eyes lately, but even when I was a little child, I thought that people who worry about that sort of thing are petty. Of course, when I was a little child, I wasn't about to be getting sneak attacks from lions anytime soon. Hi, Nana, I said. Sure you're okay with this stuff? But she just kept gazing at the images supplanting one another in front of her. One way or another, it had gotten to be a few months since Bill had called to tell me about Nana's initial stroke. I'd intended to come right out and see her, but it wasn't all that easy to arrange for a free week, and Jeff and I were having sort of vaguely severe money problems, and I just didn't manage to put a trip together until Bill called again and said that this time it was really serious. I reached over and rested my hand on Nana's. Nana had pretty much looked out for us, me and Bill and Peter, when our mother got sick. Well, died, really. And our, and our father started spending all his money on cars and driving them into things. If it hadn't been for Nana, who knows what would have happened to us? Nana gave my hand a brief, speculative look that detached it from hers, and then she turned back to the TV. From what closet had that old apparatus been unearthed? Nana had always gotten her news from the Times, as far as I knew, and other periodicals. I wondered what she was seeing. Was it just that the shifting black and white patterns engaged her attention, or did she recognize them as information and find solace in an old habit of receiving it, or did she still have some comprehension of what was happening in front of her? Enormous crowds were streaming through the streets. Refugees, I thought for an instant. Evacuations. But a lot of people were carrying large placards or banners, I saw, and I realized that this must be one of the protests. There was the Capitol building, and then something changed, and the Eiffel Tower was in the distance, and then there was something that looked like Parliament. The apartment was stifling. Despite the horrible freezing weather, I got up to open the window a crack. When I sat down again, Nana spoke. "I suppose you have no idea how I happened to be here," she said. "This is where you live, Nana," I said, in case she'd been speaking to me. "This is your home." Nana examined my face. Dispassionately, I think, would be the exact right word. No wonder my father had been terrified of her when he was growing up. She folded her hands primly and ceased to see me. My brain rolled up into a tube, and my childhood rushed through it. Pictures of coming here to this apartment with my mother and father and Peter and Bill, swift-moving, decisive Nana, smelling simply beautiful when she leaned down to me and her big, pretty teeth and all the shiny, silver hair she could twist up and pin in place in a second with some fantastic ornament, the ornate silver tea service, the delicate slice of lemon, the velvet chairs, the painting of the mysterious, beautiful, leafy world on the wall that you could practically just enter. The light, as soon as you opened the door, of a different time, the lovely, strange, tarnished light that had existed before I was born, translucent scraps of coming to see Nana went whirling through the tube and were gone. Doll-like figures sprayed into the air, broke open, and poured out blackness. There was a bulldozer and stuff crumbling. Nana had come into the world at the end of one war and lived through part of another before she left Europe, so she must have seen plenty of swarming crowds in her time and crumbling stuff and men in uniforms and little black pinpricks puncturing the clear sky. Jeff and I don't have a TV. Jeff doesn't like anything about TV, the way the set looks or the sound it makes or what it does to your brain. He says he's not so dumb that he thinks he can outsmart the brainwashing. He likes to keep his brain clean all by himself. And it does have a sparkly, pristine quality, despite the fact that it's a bit squashed by events at the moment, which occasionally causes him to make remarks that could be considered vaguely inappropriate. For example, the other day, we were going up in the elevator of the office building where Jeff and his team do their research, and there was a guy standing next to us wearing a sort of light blue churchy suit, and Jeff turned to him and said, "It's sunset." The guy glanced at Jeff and then at his watch. He glanced at Jeff again and said, "Would you mind pushing 7? Jeff said, "Yup, the sun is sinking, you guys at the helm. See it sink toward the horizon? Feel the planet turn? hear the big bones crunch at the Earth's hot core, the woolly mammoths, the dinosaurs, hear that? The fossil fuels sloshing, crunch, crunch, slosh, slosh, dinosaur sunset lullaby. I nodded to the guy when he got out at 7, but he wasn't looking. Normally, Jeff is very cogent, and he's amazingly quick to spot the specious remark or spurious explanation, especially these days if I'm the one who's made it. I don't especially mind having a TV around myself, but my concentration isn't all that terrific in certain ways, and I really can't get myself to sit down and follow what's going on in that little square window. So maybe I'm not as vulnerable to assault as Jeff is, but if someone turns on a TV in a bar, for example, I don't just have to run out screaming. In fact, I never actually do see a TV unless we happen to go out, which we really can't spare the money to do these days, even if we were to feel like it, which Jeff certainly doesn't. But TV or not, I had no trouble as I sat there next to Nana, recognizing those faces appearing in front of us, with their veiled and decorous expressions appropriate to serious matters. I suppose everyone knows those faces as well as if they were tattooed on the inside of one's eyelids. There they are, those guys, whether your eyes are open or shut. Gigantic helicopters were nosing at some mountains. I felt worn out. Flying is no joke at all these days. The interrogations at the airport and worrying about the nail scissors and those dull boomings, even though you know it's only luggage getting vaporized. And then when you finally do get mashed into place on the clanking, rickety old thing, with your blood clotting up and the awful artificial recirculated whatever it is, air or whatever, who doesn't think of great chunks of charred metal falling from the sky? Oh, well. A recollection of my father and Nana sitting in this room back when they were on viable terms, drinking something from fragile, icy little shot glasses, pressed itself urgently upon me. Though, of course, when Bill finally did stride in, allowing his overcoat to slip off into Eileen's hands, Peggy behind him, I was glad enough not to be sprawled out hiccuping. "You beat me," Bill said, and kind of whacked me a bit on the back. "That's a first." Peggy was carrying an enormous vase full of lilies, a funereal flower, if ever there was one. "Hi, Peggy," I said. "Some flowers you've got there. Melinda here, too?" "Hi, Aunt Lulu," Melinda called from the hall, where she was studying the magical glade. I had a sudden memory of the guy who'd given Nana that painting, Mr. Berman. What a handsome old man. He was one of Nana's suitors after she booted out Dad's dad. Dad used to refer to Mr. Berman as the Great Big Jew. Mr. Berman was very nice, as I remember, and rich and handsome, but Nana was sick of getting married, so he moved on, and Nana never looked back, I think. It wasn't in her nature. Peggy was staring at the TV. "Goodness me," she said, and jabbed at the remote until a few sluttish teenagers appeared, flouncing around a room with studio decor. "That's better," Peggy said. I calculated the big gloomy bouquet must have cost about what I make in a week. "Hey, Melinda," I said as she wandered into the room. "They brought you along. Great." "My sitter's mad at me," she said. "They didn't have any choice." "Alternative?" "Sure," I said. "That's fine. They didn't have any alternative." "The hell we didn't," Bill said. "We could have left her on a mountain with her ankles pierced." "Your father's just being funny," I said. "You thought that was funny, Aunt Lulu?" Melinda said. "Cute outfit, hon," Peggy told me. "The fun shirt is what?" "Poochie," I said. "Early 70s, and as is. There's a cigarette burn, see?" "Hey, Granina," Melinda said. "Watching a show, huh?" She peered at Nana scientifically and waggled her fingers in a little wave. Then she walked backward into the sofa and plopped down, showing her teeth for a moment as though she'd performed a trick. There were about 5 teenagers, all making faces and pausing for the silent audience to laugh, apparently. Peggy, who had a gift, rubbed Nana's hands and sort of chattered. Nana looked around and spoke in the strange voice that sounded like it had been shut away, gathering dust. "Everyone," she said. "Hi, Nana," we all said. "Hello, Lulu dear," she said. "Are you here?" She looked back at the TV and said, "What?" "What the hell is this?" Bill said, squinting at the flouting, mugging teenagers. He flicked the remote, and there were those familiar guys again, standing around a podium beneath a huge flag. Bill grunted and set the remote back on the table with a sharp little click. He forgot about the TV and started ranging around the room, absently picking up objects and turning them over as though he were expecting to see price tags. Poor Bill. His feelings for Nana were complicated, I knew, though he didn't seem to, heavily tinged with rage and resentment, like his feelings for everyone else. Our brother Peter was the quote-unquote outstanding one, so Bill, as the other boy, had naturally suffered a lot growing up and was kind of arrested being so compensatorily dutiful. "Poor Nana," he said. "Poor, poor Nana." Outside, someone was making some sort of commotion, screaming or something. Bill went to the window and closed it. "Listen," he said to me, "I want to thank you for coming." He had already acquired a drink, I noticed. How had he managed that? "I'm glad to be here," I said. "It's natural, isn't it?" "You don't have to thank me." "Good," he said. "I'm glad you decided to come, because decisions have to be made, and I wanted us to be united." "Against?" I said. "Against?" he said. "Decisions have to be made, and I wanted you to be part of the process." I've had a lot of practice in not getting pissed off at Bill, who can't help his patronizing autocratic nature. I reminded myself severely that, A, he's just a poor trembling soul trying to keep himself together in whatever way he can, and I should appreciate that it was Bill, obviously, who was dealing with Nana's whole thing here, and B, that I wouldn't want to start regressing all over the place. "Thanks," I said. "Thanks for including me." Bill nodded. I nodded. "Thanks for including me," I said again. "But I don't have anything to contribute, remember?" "I never said that," he said. "I never said that you don't have anything to contribute. Be straightforward for a moment. Do you think you could be straightforward for a moment? That's merely the construction you chose to put on a perfectly harmless suggestion I made once, that you might try just a little harder in certain circumstances. We'll go into another room for a minute, shall we, you and I?" "Melinda and I will stay right here with your Nana," said Peggy, who has a sort of genius for pointless remarks. Bill and I strolled down the long hall to the dining room. "I don't suppose you happen to know where the liquor cabinet is," I said. "What is it you require?" Bill said. "Absinthe? There's not enough stuff right over there on the credenza?" "Huh?" I said. "That's what it's called, a credenza. Is that all right with you?" I said, "Maybe you could be a little straightforward yourself." He said, "Sorry, I'm under a lot of..." Poor Bill. Obviously, Dad wasn't going to be pitching in here, or Peter, who's in Melbourne these days. Peter left the whole scene practically as soon as he could walk. When Peter was little, everyone thought he'd be the one to find a cure for cancer, but he became a sort of importer instead of things that are rare wherever he happens to be living, so he can be away all the time. From anywhere. Bill at least gets some satisfaction in thinking Peter's work is trivial. which really makes Jeff snicker, since Bill works for insurance companies, basically figuring out why they don't have to pay the policyholders. I remember once in this very apartment overhearing Nana tell my father that he was weak and that he resorted to the weapon of the weak, violent rage, and that he used his charm to disguise the fact that he was always just about to do whatever would make everyone most miserable. "I provided you with grandchildren," Dad told her. "Does that make you miserable? How can you complain about your grandchildren?" "How?" Nana said. "Peter is brilliant, but damaged. Lucille is certainly well-meaning, and she isn't a ninny despite appearances. But she's afraid of reality, just like you, only she expresses it in immaturity, laziness, confusion, and mental passivity." Well, that was a long, long time ago, of course, but I still remember feeling kind of sick and how quiet it was. It was so quiet I could hear the foliage in the painting rustle and the silvery dust particles clashing together. "What about Bill?" my father said. "Surely you don't intend to spare Bill." Even from behind the door where I was hiding, I could hear Nana sigh. "Poor Bill," she said that. "Poor, poor Bill." "Hey, that's my brother you're talking about," I told Jeff when he criticized Bill. And Nana would have to recognize now, if she were only compass, that Bill had taken charge of her well-being all by himself and that he was doing a pretty good job of it. "When did she stop going out?" I asked Bill. When did she stop going out? Bill said, hooking the words up like the cars of a little toy train. "When did she stop going out? When she stopped being able to walk, Lucille, after her first stroke? Kind of hard to get around if you can't walk." "Well, I guess I thought she'd use a wheelchair or something," I said, "or that someone would take her, a driver or someone." "Anyhow, she didn't want to see anyone," he said. "I told you that. I know I told you that. And more to the point, I suppose, she didn't want anyone to see her." Bill was looking stricken. The fact is, Nana was an amazing person. She'd seen a lot in her life. She'd experienced a lot. But from all those experiences, there weren't going to be many, you might say, artifacts, except for, oh, the tea service and maybe a bit of jewelry and a few pamphlets or little books, I guess, that she'd written for the Institute Foundation she worked with, at, with. The tradition of liberal humanism, I remember Dad saying once, with hatred. Anyhow, there wasn't going to be much for the world to remember our shiny Nana by, except, for example, her small, hard, rectangular book on currency. It's incredible. I can't ever quite wrap my head around it, that each life is amazingly abundant, no matter what, and every moment of experience is so intense, but so little evidence of that exists outside the living body. Billions of intense, abundant human lives on this earth, Nana's among them, vanishing, leaving nothing more than inscrutable little piles of commemorative trash. I could see that Bill was suffering from those thoughts, too. I put a hand on his arm and said, "She didn't want people to see her, but she let you see her." Bill flushed. "I don't count," he said. As far back as I can remember, Bill was subject to sudden flashes of empathy that made him almost ill for a moment, after which he was sure to behave as if someone had kicked the kick me sign on his rear end. "Anyhow, you and I have to make some decisions," he said. "Like what?" I said. He gave me plenty of time to observe his expression. "Do you know how much this sort of private care costs?" he said. "Sure, she was well-to-do by your standards and by mine, but you might pause to consider what will have happened to her portfolio in this last year or so. Mine will go back up in due course. Yours will go back up." "Portfolio?" I said. But hers won't, Bill said. She doesn't have the time. In another year, if she lives, she'll be propped up over a subway grating in the freezing cold with a paper cup to collect change. So the point is that every single thing here has to be decided, and it has to be decided either by us or by me. Honestly, Lulu, you still don't seem to get it. How do you think Nana came by her nurses? Do you think they just showed up on the doorstep one morning? Bill rubbed the bridge of his nose as if I were the one having the tantrum. The point is, he said, there seems to be no chance of significant recovery. So what will happen with her things, for example? Who will go through her papers? Can we find a better place for her to be? These are decisions. These were not decisions. I didn't bother to point out to Bill, who was looking really so pathetic with his silly jacket and premature pot belly. They were questions. This is Nana's apartment, I said. This is where she lives. We can't just, what, send her off on an ice floe? I appreciate your horror of the sordid mechanics, Bill said, but stay on task, please. Focus. I mean, driver? Good Lord, Lulu, what driver? You know, Jeff is a fine man. I like Jeff, and it's a big relief to see you settle down finally with someone other than a blatant madman. But Jeff is as impractical as you are, more impractical if possible. He takes an extreme view of things, and I know he encourages you in that as well. I'm capable of forming my own extreme views, I said, and if you're referring to the tree painting project, it was hardly extreme. We all just picked one tree that was going to be deforested and commemorated that particular tree in paint. I don't call that extreme. I agree, Bill said. It's perfectly harmless. And that's great because you have to be prudent. Courage is one thing and simplistic rashness is another. There are lists, you know. Simplistic rashness, I said. You know what Jeff has been doing. You know what he's been studying. I was shouting at Bill, but I was thinking about poor Jeff lying in bed this last month or so, scrawling on sheets of paper. When I'd urge him to eat, he'd start intoning statistics. How many babies born with this? How many babies born with that? I know, I said the other day. I know. Don't tell me. Tell them. We've told them, he said. That's why they cut off the funding. My mouth was still open, I noticed, and yelling at my brother. The funding's been cut off, my mouth was shouting, for the whole study. And now they're saying depleted uranium. Wow, it's great for you. Sprinkle it on your breakfast cereal. Is it any wonder Jeff isn't a barrel of laughs these days? Is it any wonder he's on a short fuse? Extreme? You're the one who's extreme. I can absolutely hear how you're trying to pretend his name is spelled. Jeff is Jewish, okay? Do you think you can handle it? His name is Jeff with a J, not waspy, waspy Jeff with a G. But every time you send us so much as a note, it's Dear Lulu and Jeff with a G. Bill was just standing there with his arms folded. At least I send the occasional note, he said. And please don't pretend you don't know what a portfolio is. Please, please don't. The Corot will have to be sold, he said. Sold, I said. Well, I don't know why it should have made a difference to me. Sold, not sold. It wasn't as if I could have hung the thing up on our stained, peeling wall. But still, that word, sold, it's like inadvertently knocking over a glass. Sold, Bill said. The jewelry's already been sold. Eek, I said. Who knew? Oops, sorry, you did. I get it. Honest, I do. Bill cleared his throat. Anyhow, he said, obviously there's a lot of stuff left, but none of it's worth anything to speak of. Peggy's researched pretty thoroughly. Still, if there's anything you want, now's the time to claim it. Now's the time. Who wants to hear that about anything? Thanks, I said. Was there anything of Nana's I'd particularly ever coveted? I closed my eyes. Wait a minute, I said. Nana's still alive. You get no argument from me there, Bill said. But how much of this stuff do you think she's going to be using from now on? Do you think she'll be using the tea service, for example? The tea service, I said, do you want the tea service, he said. The tea service? I said, that great big hulking silver thing? What on earth would I do with the tea service? How on earth do you think Jeff and I are living out in the woods? Why are we talking about the tea service? Excuse me a minute. I went into the kitchen where Eileen was sitting, grabbed a glass from the cupboard, and clattered some ice cubes into it from a tray in the freezer. Excuse me, I said. Help yourself, dear, Eileen said. There was a printed notice stuck to the door of the fridge with a magnet that looked like a cherry. Do not resuscitate, the notice said. Oh, shit, I said. Eileen nodded. She's a lovely lady, your grandmother. When I went back out to the dining room, it appeared that Bill had gone back to the others, so I made a pit stop at the credenza to fill my glass and return to the living room myself. Anyhow, Bill said, we weren't talking about the tea service. You were talking about the tea service. The tea service? Peggy said. Want it? I said. That's so sweet of you, hon, Peggy said. Bill flashed an expression just like one of Dad's, pure, gleeful, knowing malevolence. He'd obviously stopped by the good old credenza himself again and was gulping away at his tumbler. Eileen came in and helped Nana drink a glass of water with something in it to make it thick enough for her to swallow and gave her a pill. A little water dribbled from the corner of Nana's mouth. Nana didn't appear to notice it. Eileen wiped it away, then wiped at something leaking from Nana's eye. Melinda had her hands over her ears. Those airplanes, she said. I can't stand the sound of those airplanes. Why are there so many airplanes here? Oh, don't fuss, Melinda, Peggy said. There are airports in New York City, and so naturally there are airplanes. And in any case, that's a helicopter. Oh, and in any case, that's a helicopter, Bill said. Is it going to drop a bomb on us? Melinda said. Don't be silly, sweetie, Peggy said. They're not dropping bombs on us. We're dropping bombs on them. Helicopters don't drop bombs, Melinda, Bill said. They're probably looking for someone. Who? Melinda said. The police, Bill said. Hear those sirens? No, but who are the police looking for? Melinda said with her hands over her ears again. How would your mother and I know who the policemen are looking for? Bill said. Some criminal, I suppose. Melinda flopped over face down onto the sofa and let out a muffled wail. Just calm down, please, Melinda, Peggy said. You're upsetting your great-grandmother. Melinda cast a glance at Nana, who was gazing levelly at the images I'd seen earlier of the gracefully exploding building. I wondered where the building was. What country, for instance? Things were always occurring suddenly and decisively inside the TV. Another building, for example, was just getting sheared off as we watched from an even taller one standing next to it. Why is everyone always so mad at me? Melinda said. We are not angry with you, Peggy said, and I've told you repeatedly that when you pay for the paint job, you can put tape wherever you like. I was doing it for you, Melinda said. I was just doing it for you. She turned to me. It said to do it. It said to get tape and put plastic over the windows because of the poison, and my sitter was up in my room with her boyfriend, so I got the tape from the drawer and some garbage bags, and then Stacy was mad at me, too, even though I didn't tell that she and Brett were upstairs having... I don't want you talking like that, Peggy said. About Stacy or anyone else, young lady. Girls in real life don't behave like television floozies. I'm limiting your viewing time. What did I say? What did I say? Melinda said and lapsed into loud, tearing wails. Stop it, Melinda, Peggy said. Stop that right this instant. You're getting hysterical. She's so theatrical, Peggy said to me, rolling her eyes. She put her arms around Melinda, who continued crying loudly. There's no reason to get so excited, Melinda. You're just overtired. Soldiers were marching across the screen again. Peggy was gazing at them absently, her chin resting on Melinda's soft hair. Was Melinda going to be a numbskull like her parents, I wondered? But then I reminded myself how much stress Peggy and Bill were under, worrying about Nana all the time, and Peggy was looking so tired and sad, just gazing droopily at the screen. She sighed. "Do you remember when people could have veal chops whenever they wanted?" she said. "Bill had a yen for veal chops yesterday, so I went to the market and I practically had to take out a mortgage." "Are we poor?" Melinda said, and hiccuped. "Ask your mother," Bill said, and looked like Dad again. I was trying to remember what Nana had written in her little book on currency, fixed, floating, imports, exports, economies, and then I tried to remember what exactly had happened in the last wars we'd fought, or anyhow in the last vaguely recent ones, just who exactly was involved and so on. So many facts, so much information always coming out about these things after they've occurred. It's pretty hard to keep straight just what's been destroyed, where, and how many were killed. Well, I guess it's not that hard for the people who live in those places. And Jeff always has a pretty solid grasp on that stuff, and Nana sure used to. I wondered what she thought she was looking at now. If she thought she was actually seeing back, looking at pictures from her own life, memories. She seemed to be focusing on the screen so intently, as if she were concentrating on some taxing labor, really working out what the screen was showing. Well, that was Nana, always work, 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 work. There was the sheared-off building and the tall one still standing right next to it. It looked like an office building with black windows. Maybe Nana thought that Death's office was there behind those black windows. Maybe she pictured Death as a handsome old man in uniform, sitting at his desk and going over his charts and graphs. Behind him, she'd be seeing a huge map with pins in it, and his generals with those familiar, familiar faces, their expressions bright now in private as they reviewed their sleek and potent devices. But Death himself would look tired, so much to do, and sad. He wouldn't notice the glass tear leaking from his glass eye. "Guess we'll all be going together one of these days," Bill said. "Swell," I said. "You know, guys, I'm really tired. I'm going back downtown to Juliet's. We can talk over everything tomorrow, okay?" "Do you have enough money for a taxi, Lulu?" Bill said. "Do I have enough money for a taxi? Of course I have enough money for a taxi," I said. I was wishing I hadn't spent most of my last check before Jeff's funding was cut on those white Courage go-go boots. But discounts are about the only perk of my job, and I do have to say that the boots look pretty fabulous. "Anyhow," I said, "I'm going to take the subway." "The subway?" Peggy said. "Don't be insane, Lulu." "Don't die, Aunt Lulu," Melinda said. "For pity's sake," Peggy said, "no one is going to die." Was I ever hoping that Wendell had finished trying to tenderize Juliet so I could just flop down on her futon? "No rest for the wicked," Dad used to say, chortling, as he'd head out for a night on the town. "Or for the saintly," is what Jeff has to say about that. "Or for the morally indecipherable." "Oh, look," Peggy said, pointing to the screen, where a grinning person in a white coat was standing near some glass beakers and holding what looked like a little spool. "I think they must be talking about that new thread." "What new thread? What new thread?" Melinda said. "That new thread," Peggy said. "I read an article about this new thread that's electronic." "Electronic? I think that's right. Anyhow, they've figured out how to make some kind of thread that's able to sense your skin temperature and chemical changes and things. And they're going to be able to make clothes that can monitor your body for trouble. So that if you have conditions like diabetes, I think, or some kind of dangerous conditions, your clothes will be able to register what's going on and protect you. That's great, huh, Granina? Melinda said. She threw her little arms around Nana, who closed her eyes as if she were finally taking a break. That's it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I love that story.
I'm glad.
And so maybe I can start with a question about it, because what's so interesting to me is how many different threads you get going. You've got the TV that Nana's watching, you've got Lulu and Bill in their fight, and Lulu's background, and this little information about the painting, and most amazing to me is when Lulu speculates about Nana and what she's seeing, because it seems like in a normal story that would be coming from the author and it would actually be what the character was really thinking, but because it's Lulu, it has this whole extra dimension. And I'm going to turn this into a question, I promise.
Oh, no, I'm fascinated.
So there's this, I guess it's like this sort of fugue, and I'm curious how you balance that, and you don't give us a lot of help, really, when we switch from one of those places to another. Suddenly it's an image from the TV, and you don't always say that it is.
Yeah.
And I see that in this entire book, a very interesting kind of withdrawal of the exposition, I guess.
Yeah.
How did that interest come about?
I'm going to backtrack a bit to sort of different maybe segments of what you
okay.
mentioned. I give amazingly little help in this story. And of course, no one could hear the fact that there are no quotation marks in this story, which actually, I was desperate to get it to work without quotation marks. And I'm not sure why. I mean, you're asking me why, basically.
Yes.
I want it to be like that. And I just wanted it to just come sort of racing along like a fugue, exactly.
Yeah.
Like a fugue.
And, you know, the first time I read this story, I think I was a few pages in, and I really had to and wanted to go back because I thought, well, who's Eileen? And I didn't know where I was. And
yeah.
And there's this great anxiety about it because you are following the moment, but then there's this larger context that you just don't really give us, but it puts this tremendous pressure. Is the context there for you in your mind and you're deliberately holding it out, or is it something that you might not know while you're working?
Well, by the time I'm finished, because things do take me so long, yeah, I know pretty much everything. I think, like many of my contemporaries, feel a kind of horror of exposition. Of doing it myself,
yeah.
Not of reading expository work. At all.
Because you're a bit unique, because most of your contemporaries, they get rid of the who, what, when, where, why pretty fast. They sort of set it up but there is this real anxiety in your stories because that's just not there so much.
Right, you've got to struggle to place yourself, maybe. It's funny, I read a very striking quote of Bryce Martin's the other day that was in a piece about him in the New York Review. And it was about, he said something about the impulse of 20th century art to get closer and closer to the, to get the picture plane closer and closer to the surface.
Yeah.
And I was intensely struck by that because it struck such a chord with me. And there's something, there's a kind of distance that I'm always striving to eclipse between the reader and the page, as if somehow the reader were actually standing in the page.
Sure, because lots of that exposition is quite artificial. It's done to benefit a reader, to embrace and to be sort of a good host, but it doesn't wouldn't necessarily be occurring in the moment.
Right.
You know, right. If it's Lulu's story, she knows who Bill is.
Right. So, she knows who Bill is.
And yeah. So it's artificial to say who he is, but.
And of course, it's quite a trick, and I do lose a lot of readers because a lot of readers do feel that I haven't adequately accomplished the trick of getting people to, of getting the reader, of enabling the reader to know what's going on without
saying. I think you do it, though. I think you're doing it, but without the exposition. I forget the title of the story in your book, Twilight of the Superheroes, in which a woman has kidnapped the child of her boyfriend.
It's called Window, yeah.
And the story opens, I believe, with the woman is on the run. Of course, we don't know this. I think it's a conversation she's having with her sister,
yeah,
who's come over, and there's a child. And this could look like any number of domestic American short stories. But we don't know that she's in a lot of trouble, and someone could be hunting her down, and very likely maybe will kill her when he finds her. I mean, this man turns out to be, I thought, a very worrisome character. And it was such an interesting choice for us just not to know any of that, because that scene, yet that scene still had this worry built into it, without any facts.
Yeah, I mean, you used the word artificial earlier, and of course that's exactly always the issue, is since we're doing something that's highly artificial and often using very artificial means, a series of techniques that are very artificial, mm-hmm. But it's all in the service of making something that is an actual experience.
What that moment is really like.
Yes, yeah. And that's totally what I'm interested yeah. in. That's almost the entirety of my interest, the composition of a moment, the feeling of a moment, the sensation of a moment.
I see that a lot as well with sometimes when we get very deep inside one of your characters' heads, there's a real fragmentation also that I don't see in a lot of stories, and the thoughts are broken, the partial words, nothing gets finished or resolved, and when I read that, I think, well, that's me. That's exactly right. That the pieces don't go together.
Pieces don't go together. It's all a sort of construct. I guess I'm borrowing my own phrase, that it's an a posteriori. It's not really. We don't really interpret experience while we're having it. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm trying to sort of sneak in under the fence before the interpretation quite comes in.
Yeah. Maybe we can back up. I would love to hear, I guess, how a story starts to evolve for you. You say that it takes you a long time. I would love to hear You mentioned that this story, Revenge of the Dinosaurs, started out of rage of this experience you had in the city. Is there that sort of sudden kind of aha moment that gets you going into something, or do you work in little pieces and stitch things together? And then how do you start assembling and making it whole?
You know, oddly enough, and I wonder if this is true of you, I don't remember afterwards what it's like to work on something, what it was like to work on something. But, I mean, I've never had an idea in my life, unfortunately. And I have to work without them.
But yet... It seems, though, that you actually have found a way to have a lot of ideas. I mean, Lulu is a sort of surrogate philosopher. And there's actually a lot of almost straight philosophy and political theory. But of course, it's filtered in a social way. It's all coming out as a social act. And so it's relieved of having to be right. And in fact, the more skewed it is, the more character that gets generated, the more tension. So, I mean, I feel so many ideas in what you write.
I suppose I mean that I've never had an idea for a story.
I know, it is a terrible question. Where do you get your ideas?
I sort of rely on the piece of paper to tell me.
Yeah.
And I find that they actually, the piece of paper contains the stuff. If there are people here who feel that they might really like to try writing sometime, but they feel unsuited towards it or fearful that they won't come up with something, I would just like to say that that is, I think, the natural condition.
The sort of prerequisite.
It's almost the prerequisite, yeah.
Well, and it is always suspicious when people know their stories in advance.
Some people really do. Some people really know where they're headed. They've got their characters. And some people have a kind of gift for narrative, which, Lord knows, I don't. But are very interested in narrative, whereas I'm very interested in almost something that is hostile to narrative in a way, which is, I mean, there is in narrative a sort of implicit assumption of causality that I find kind of a little bit shoddy. Now, of course...
You mean the sequence of events in a story that this happened because of this?
Yeah. And now, a really good narrative, of course, is always fighting, is always kind of butting up against that.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of in some way proves or reveals the connection between things.
Sure.
But I've always been sort of very uneasy with the idea of causality. And so for me, something that goes from the beginning to the end has to rely on something else to do it.
So then, if you strip it away, how do you know when you're done, or what is a whole shape? And the end of the story you read tonight, it is so incredible to come back to the grandmother. I mean, she's this sort of mute presence. Everything violent is revolving around her, and yet she's this sort of strange little oracle, and everything gets projected onto her. And so there really is, narratively speaking, a lot of order.
Yeah.
in the story, while it seems like chaos and the end seems neat in this narrative sense.
I feel quite oddly sure-footed about structure.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always pretty certain about what goes where. I tend to work sequentially, and I think I've always known when something is finished, where it ought to finish. I'm told that my stories are inconclusive, but I always think, gosh, there it is. That's right. Where it ought to stop.
When you're writing about something that might reflect the world as we know it in a really direct way, I'm thinking of the title story in your latest book,
yeah.
Which deals very obliquely with the events of September 11th. I thought it was a very interesting and unusual approach. I mean, it seemed that after that, writers had to take a side. I will write about it. I won't write about it. This is why. I'm curious. Throughout your career, there are some stories that one can very directly trace, say, to a political event. Is it a different compositional process to you, or are you worried about different things? Is there something else at stake for you? Do you feel there'll be more scrutiny, or
more scrutiny from readers or critics, or
the people who matter to you, or yeah.
Well, there's certainly, I've been chided quite a bit for writing that is sort of recognizably political, identifiably political. But I don't think about it. It doesn't fall into categories for me because, you know, I'm a fiction writer. I'm not a political analyst. I'm not. I'm not a theorist. And so my way to develop an understanding of something is fictional. And what I'm always concerned with is experience. And it's just that the content of my, you know, I'm always just using the content of my head, but sometimes, I mean, I would say all of our brains were just invaded by the public sphere. There was certainly a period of a few years when I'd say very few of us really had much of a private life.
Right.
And I think that's, we can't have a private life any longer, or at this time, we're too intimately connected with the events on the planet.
Was there a temptation in that story to make September 11th sort of more central? I mean, it what was interesting to me is that it very much plays a sort of supporting role in a portrait of a character who's casting about and not particularly directly affected by it or particularly moved by it. And so it's there as a it's landscape, and it's an incredible amount of context. And I'm curious about that decision.
Because
obviously other writers just went right at it.
I think what I was interested in primarily, I'm going to again loop back. And the compositional process, as you called it, was different for me with that story from anything else I've ever written. I started keeping notes, which is something that I have never done before and may never do again. But I started on September 12th, 2001, to keep notes because, not with the purpose of writing a story at all, but because I knew that I would sort of develop, I and everybody else, you forget things very, very fast. You forget how you actually felt. You, develop a stance. You think that you felt a certain way. You think that certain things were happening. And I've always been sort of curious about, I was sort of expecting things to happen as they subsequently did, and or fearing that they might. And, I always wondered how my parents felt, for instance, the day the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima.
Yeah.
I wondered how people felt, and I've never really known. And, when you feel your culture gearing up, your society gearing up to, it was a moment, an unresolved moment, before people had taken a position, before people had made a choice, before people had decided, how to behave. And I was very interested in that moment of uncertainty, and particularly as I anticipated that the mode would become one of retribution and punishment, I wanted to see what went into that.
And to protect the perspective that you had at that moment.
Just to see how it came about that certain attitudes developed. And in this story that I read, I was similarly interested in the mind becoming deflected from a shameful involvement, for example.
I'm really interested in how concentrated your stories are. And to me, I feel that I can read them slowly and really immerse myself. And the short story seems to be stereotyped as this kind of perfect mechanism in which every word must be there. This is the ideal short story, but yet it's often cited for its limitations, and I've really never seen those limitations in effect in your stories. But I know that the lazier press about writers who just write stories it always seems to revert back to this question: where's your novel? As though the novel is the only place one can actually really show something.
Yeah,
I'm curious if you've just not been interested in novels for your writing.
I have no, I just do what happens. I take the road of least resistance. But actually, it's true that I'm very interested in compression. I love compression. And I sort of feel, I start with the novel and then I cut. I feel that, if you've ever read Crossing into Poland by Isaac Babel, it's one page. It's got everything in the world is in that story. Everything in the world is in that story. I mean, would it have been better if it were?
It's interesting, though, that the culture wants to assign this value to the novel, and yet we are supposed to have short attention spans.
I know.
And so it would seem that the story would be this ready-made product that would actually sell better than the novel, and yet the novel is holding its own as the more important form.
Definitely. And I mean, it's definitely, people do just constantly say to me, basically, when are you going to grow up and write something?
Yeah.
I don't, you know, of course, a story, in my view, is a kind of vertical novel, you know, lots of layers. And I think even though we have short attention spans, we don't necessarily have great attention spans. And they're actually quite hard to read. Stories are pretty demanding, a lot of stories.
Well, there can really just be this intensity that can be hard to be in the presence of that.
Yeah.
And the novel, you can read 30 pages and still think, well, this is all wind up. That's why I don't really feel anything yet.
But I once had...
Some novels.
I once had a student who said to me, well, you know, I really feel if I'm going to make the commitment, you know, it's like going on a date or getting married. If I'm gonna make the commitment, I want to read a novel. And I do think it's true. It does, as you were saying yesterday. Reading it's hard. It does take a certain degree of energy.
I met some high school students this morning who had been involved in a November novel writing project, some kind of national thing where people write a novel every November.
And is that like
one
a
of them
language?
One of them had made it, and he actually said, I made it. And the other had not quite made it. And I said, well, you could still work on it even though it's no longer November.
December.
And he felt that he couldn't work on it, that he had had this limited time to work on it, and that was, he had just missed his chance.
Right into the fireplace.
Well, maybe as a last question, could you say at all what you might be working on now? Is there anything you can tell us?
I'm not working on a thing, as far as I know.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.